Slavery was an institution where one human being had absolute control over another human being. They might be here tomorrow, they might be sold the next day.
It was, in many ways, hopelessness condensed. They could not control where they went, what they did, what they ate, who they could marry, or even how they would conduct their religious lives. And so for many of these folks, it was truly just a step above the grave.
Into this inhuman system, slavery, young Frederick quickly came of age.
It must have been terribly dehumanizing. On the one hand, Douglas and slaves like him were aware that there were free people of color and wondered certainly how that could be, why it was that there were some people who were free and some people who remained slaves, like he and his grandmother and his other relatives. And when you had free people in the midst of slaves in that way, it certainly did make the slaves long for freedom even more.
The fact that Frederick Douglass learned how to read at all is amazing, because in slavery, slaves were not supposed to learn how to read. It turned out that his mistress taught him how to read, despite the fact her own husband was not happy with the fact that she was doing that.
From that moment, I understood the pathway from slavery to freedom.
When Frederick Douglass got a job in the shipyard in Baltimore, he was still a slave, but he was an urban slave. That is, he was rented out to someone who then paid him for his work.
Allowed to keep a portion of his shipyard wages, Frederick eagerly saved to buy his first book.
The first book that Frederick Douglass read was The Columbian Orator. And it's not really accurate to say he read it. He memorized it. He practiced it. These were a collection of famous speeches. And as he read them, he'd read them over and over again, and then he would practice them. He would practice the tone of voice. He would practice the way he was to would deliver these speeches.
In Baltimore, Douglass finds a community of free blacks. He finds religious institutions. He finds friends and perhaps even mentors in the black community, and a sense of social identity.
There were many schemes that slaves employed to acquire their freedom in the North. Henry Brown mailed himself to Philadelphia in a box. Still other slaves found freedom by becoming passengers on the Underground Railroad. He continued to New York and was joined there by Anna Murray. They were married and resumed the journey north to New Bedford in Massachusetts.
He's still a slave. He's a runaway slave. He was a fugitive slave. And in the United States at that time, a fugitive slave, if found out, if captured, could be returned to slavery no matter how long he stayed in the place of his escape.
Within months of his arrival in New Bedford, Douglass learned of the abolition movement.
William Lloyd Garrison was perhaps the most prominent of the abolitionists of that period, and he was one of the group known as immediatists. These were abolitionists who wanted slavery to end immediately.
He becomes interested in the newspaper published by William Lloyd Garrison called The Liberator, and becomes aware of the network of abolitionists that exist throughout the northeastern states. And Garrison speaks, Douglass is electrified. Garrison learns that an escaped slave is in the crowd and asks Douglass to stand up and say a few words.
Men and women are in a semicircle on the podium, and Douglass stands up at the lectern and begins his talk, and quietly the voice begins, and he tells stories about having been a slave, what slave life was like. And for 2 hours, the audience will be just hanging on every word, just a huge crowd. And he will work that crowd like a preacher.
Garrison, too, was impressed with Douglass and determined that Douglass could be of enormous help to the anti-slavery cause. And so fairly soon thereafter, Douglass is recruited to go about the country and lecture on behalf of the anti-slavery society.
By 1843, Douglas had embarked with Garrison on the 100 Conventions Project, a six-month tour of anti-slavery meetings in New England, Ohio, Illinois, and Indiana. As an abolitionist speaker, Douglas was regularly singled out for attack by pro-slavery supporters. Still, the great speaker would evolve into a persuasive writer.
Douglas publishes his first biography, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, in 1845. In that autobiography, he does give details. He gives information about his owners. He talks about the area from which he had escaped. And he does so at great risk to himself. He knows that now the owner does know where he is and certainly could send a slave catcher to get him.
In order to protect himself, in fact, he goes to England. And he stays in England for almost 2 years because he indeed believes, and others believe, that he will be taken back into slavery.
While in England, friends of his collect money for his purchase, and they make arrangements with his owner to have him sold to them, of course, and Douglas gets his freedom that way.
In 1847, Douglas returned to the United States, not as a fugitive slave, but as a free man.
On his return from England, Frederick Douglass moves to Rochester, New York, and begins to publish a newspaper, the North Star.
I was like, how does slavery work? You got one fat white guy on a plantation and you have 50 strong black slaves. How the hell does he keep them in line? Why don't they like kill him or beat him up or run away or something? They're way stronger than he is. You know, he might have a gun, but you know, he's gonna sleep sometime. It didn't occur to me until much later. And then I had a more thorough understanding after I read the autobiography of Frederick Douglass, who was a slave. Most of them thought they were supposed to be slaves. And that's really hard for people today to understand and believe. What do you mean they thought they were supposed to be slaves? And Frederick Douglass talked about his own journey of realizing, I don't think this is okay. And to me, and the guy was brilliant, like his writings are just brilliant. To me, physically escaping slavery was way less impressive than reading about his mental escape from slavery, where he noticed the indoctrination and he undid it in himself, and then he tried to undo it in others, and he would argue with them, and they would, a lot of the slaves would literally believe that to run away is immoral and constitutes stealing, because you're stealing yourself from the guy who rightfully owns you. That is how powerful this indoctrination can be. Let me use Frederick Douglass's own words. To make a contented slave, you must make a thoughtless one. It is necessary to darken his moral and mental vision, and as far as possible, to annihilate his power of reason. He must be able to detect no inconsistencies in slavery. That's the part of the quote you usually hear. I'm going to add what comes next. The man that takes his earnings must be able to convince him that he has a perfect right to do so. It must not depend upon mere force. The slave must know no higher law than his master's will. The whole relationship must not only demonstrate to his mind its necessity, but its absolute rightfulness. Now we can look back and say, that was horrible. How did they ever believe it? Oop, it's tax time. And you're bad if you don't pay. Because, hey, the man that takes your earnings has a perfect right to do so, doesn't he? Because it's law and taxation, and we voted, and there's all this mythology and constitutions and stuff. Ta-da, they have the right to take our money.
Frederick Douglass. I read his autobiography, a number of his works, while I was in prison for not bowing to the IRS, which is an interesting thing to read. Read about slavery while you're in a cage for not paying money to your master. But one of the most amazing things was reading his account of how at some point the master said, I will let you go and work for other people, and I'll even let you keep a little bit of the money. Of course, I get most of it and I decide how much I take, but I'll let you go work and earn money of your very own. Aren't I generous? And Frederick Douglass explained how at first he was all excited. He was like, this is awesome. I can go out and work hard and have my own money. And then he realized this is worse than just direct slavery, because it's me pretending that he's being nice to me. Well, if I'm entitled to any of it, I'm entitled to all of it. Like, it's my work. And so Frederick Douglass basically figured out that an income tax is worse than direct slavery because of the mental implications that they're letting you keep some, which is 100% slavery, because it's saying it's their decision, but you're supposed to be thankful and grateful that they didn't take 100% of it. So I almost fell out of my chair when I read a former slave basically saying that an income tax is worse than direct slavery because of what it implies. Because if somebody just comes up and says, you're going to work for me or I'm going to hurt you, at least it's brutally honest. It's completely evil and immoral, but it's honest. But if they say, oh, we're just going to take some of you, we'll decide how much we take, but we'll let you keep some. It's like the carjackers, I'm going to let you keep your wallet. I'm taking your car, but I'm so benevolent that I'm going to let you keep your wallet. It's like, why would you think you get positive points when you're robbing me at gunpoint? And that is what the income tax is masters pretending that they're kind because they didn't take all of it. And it was so funny to read Frederick Douglass, his explanation of him figuring out this is somehow worse. This is a bigger insult than just saying, do what I say because I own you. It's even worse because it kind of admits that your effort and your time and effort belong to you, but not really. I'll decide how much to take anyway.
It's this insidious vampirism on a person that when you do that generationally, and then you have generations removed from this that they're just in this world now. They have no idea what's going on. They don't know. And now they're a part of this, and it becomes even more insidious because there is no overt guy with a whip and a chain anymore. This is the luxury of America, where even the poor are entitled to have smartphones, goddammit. So people have nice distractions and they have pretty things and they don't have a guy browbeating them every day. So when you try to tell them they're a slave and they don't particularly see it like that, you know, and they can't see it that way, it's more insidious, it's more creepy, because now we have this generationally and people are just like, yeah, I guess I go and work, and then some people just take a bunch of my paycheck for some reason, and everyone tolerates that. Oh well, not gonna try too hard to fight that because everybody else is doing it, and people just accept that because
that's like the only two certain things in life are death and taxes. Like, guess who made that up? The beneficiaries of the theft.